Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
The Rewind with Henry McKean. This is News Talk.
You're very welcome to The Rewind with me, Henry McKean. We're going to take a nostalgic look back on a year. Today, we're going back to the 90s. The year is 1997. Over the next hour, we'll be chatting to the game changers from 1997. The movies, Titanic, LA Confidential, The Full Monty, Bertie Ahern, Coming to Power, New Labour, Sweeping Britain, and the death of Lady Diana. Pop bands like Steps were established, and Michael Flatley's The Lord of the Dance took over the world. Here are people on their memories of 1997.
Louise O'Reilly from Skerries. 1997 would have been the year my daughter turned two. It was the year that I graduated from UCD. And I do remember, and I remember it very, very well. My husband surprised me with a trip to Paris. We didn't have very much money, so we stayed with his auntie and we travelled over on really awful flights just after I graduated. And 97 was a good year. It was a good year for myself and my family, actually. We had a nice year.
And the news, what do you remember from that time?
Well, I do remember the Gravahi Road, all right, and I also remember the death of the British Princess of Wales because that was covered. I think we'd never really seen coverage. Blanket coverage like that. I don't think we'd ever seen that kind of blanket coverage. It was on every news program, and it coincided with my daughter's birthday, which is, we didn't talk about it at her birthday, but then we were flooded with the news, and it was before social media, so it's hard to imagine that we were being flooded with something, but we were at that stage. And I think it was the first time we kind of seen that level of blanket coverage.
What do you remember from 1997?
It would definitely be the death of Princess Diana.
Diana dying in the car crash. View that really stood out, and she was with her companion Dodi Al-Fayed and the driver Henri Paul.
That's right, yeah. I remember
also died.
The paparazzi being blamed for the chase.
Chasing her in the tunnel.
Yeah, that I won't forget.
What are your memories of 1997?
I was in Ibiza on holiday, and when we were leaving that morning, we came down to the bar and it was all over the tellies.
This is Diana dying.
That's how I remember 97.
More on Diana a bit later on. But first, I got to sit down with 1997 pop band Steps. Steps have sold over 25 million records, and they were here in Dublin promoting their new musical, Here and Now. It took place in the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre.
5, 6, 7, 8. Hi, I'm Lee.
Hi, I'm Faye.
I'm H.
Hi, I'm Lisa.
And I'm Claire.
We are Steps. I want to bring you back, way back to 1997.
The year.
Well, so you know when you started out, and the fact that, you know, obviously some of you were involved in different bands beforehand and different pop groups and stuff like that, and karaoke. Tell us a little bit about that time and coming together and your memories of 1997.
I think, God, it does seem like such a long time ago now, doesn't it? But it was, obviously we were put together. H and Lisa were actually in another incarnation of Steps before. There were three other members before myself, Faye and Lee joined.
It didn't work.
As soon as we joined, it did. It was just a very exciting time. It was a really exciting time for pop music, actually. I think it was really the heyday of pop. And we were lucky to be involved in it back then. You know, the Spice Girls were flying, and there was Boyzone and Take That, and E17 had kind of already been and gone. And there was a bit of that Brit pop thing, but pop really was coming out on top at that time. So it was it was perfect timing for us and a very exciting time. So, yeah.
And you're right, it was Britpop and stuff like that. I was chatting to a friend this morning and he was all about Oasis because they were here recently and now you're here. And it turns out he is a big
Steps fan, and he used to follow you all those years ago. The fact that you've sold something like 22 million records,
you've
25. Thank you so much for correcting me.
It'll be about 40 by the end of the day.
by the end of this chat, you know, do you think you have a lot of, you could say, quiet or secret fans out there?
I think we used to. Mm. I feel like they've all come out of the closet now.
Yeah. Loud and proud.
And I feel like everybody is happy to admit that we were part of their childhood and nostalgia. But back in the day, I think there were so many people that did come to concerts that wouldn't shout about it.
And now, secret Steps like albums.
It feels like the opposite. I feel like even like towards our music, you know, we have people like Sia who are giving us tracks for our music because they were fans back in the day. And it's a real turnaround for us. It's quite an amazing place to be in now.
H, everyone gets to ask you this, and everyone asks you.
Oh, wait.
This, yes, you know,
I
you know, what I'm going to ask. You know,
you yes, know. What I am.
So,
a multitude of things. Quite funny.
So the meme that keeps being sent to me of the basically. H on the side of the streets. The
oh my goodness,
that's still
oh
going.
God.
Oh, is that the gravestone?
Yes. How does that make you feel?
Well, do you know what? I used it as my profile picture for a while.
Did
yeah, because everybody kept sending me. I was like, right, how do I quash this? So that's what I did.
It makes you feel a deeper shade of blue.
Or tragedy is probably a better one.
Yeah.
And that isn't your gravestone. That's for the fire brigade, isn't it? So
it's
fine water, isn't it?
I have no idea, but thank you.
Without being too morbid, you won't have a gravestone like that, will you?
I've never really thought about it, but
Ireland is going through a bit of a change in Eurovision. Why haven't you done Eurovision yet?
Thank you, because not all of us want to.
Since you were a democracy.
You're working on it, getting everyone on board.
We'll do the halftime show, how about that?
I am a Eurovision boy. I love Eurovision, and there are some cracking songs to come out of Eurovision.
I'm a fan of the show, but I don't want to perform on it.
Yeah, we'll do the halftime show, like Lee said.
You're going to do the halftime show, and you know, and that's the thing. It's nostalgia, getting back to the 90s. Yeah. Was it the best decade?
It was.
Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%.
Well, look, Steps, thank you so much for chatting to News Talk. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
Cheers.
And sorry about the tragedy.
No! How do you say thank you in Gaelic? Gurav ma good.
Gurav ma good.
Good attempt.
Gurav ma good.
Gurav ma good.
Tragedy.
So Steps there, Claire Richards, Faye Tozer, H, Lee Latchford-Evans, and Lisa Scott-Lee. Another legend of 97 was Michael Flatley. The Irish dancer, he made $1 billion out of The Lord of the Dance. I caught up with him.
Hi, I'm Henry from News Talk. I'm here to interview Michael Flatley.
Michael, you are a very humorous man. We're here sitting opposite the point, now the Three Arena. If we go back 30 years, you started something huge, which reinvented, if I could say that, traditional Irish dance. Bring us back 30 years ago.
Yeah, fantastic memories, fantastic times. In fact, to be honest, Henry, first of all, thank you for having me on your show. Sitting here right now, really, it warms my heart and it brings back fabulous memories. It's very emotional sitting by the Three Arena, which was the point at the time. And back 30 years ago, when I started this whole thing, nobody gave me any chance. Nobody gave me any chance. Even my family, even my best friends told me I was crazy to go ahead and do this, that I had a drive and a passion that was unstoppable. And I always say in life, if you follow your dream, if you believe in your own heart and your own vision and you're willing to work hard, nothing's impossible. And I believe in hard work, and I'm not shy of hard work in many times in life. And I'm sure you've encountered it in your own life and your listeners. You're going to come up against brick walls. You got to find a way. You got to round it. You got to go over it, go under it, go around it, or crash through it, but find a way to the other side. That's what we did with Lord of the Dance. That's why we sold out every big arena around the world. That's why those fabulous young dancers you saw today are still traveling the world, doing what they love and earning a living and promoting Ireland and Irish culture.
And those dancers look fantastic, and you're right. So if I get the years right, in about 1996, because of creative differences, you set up Lord of the Dance and Riverdance went a different way. And then I'm going to bring you to the year 1997. I really want to concentrate on that year. I read that that year, The Lord of the Dance really was absolutely huge, global, $1 billion. You made quite a few bob out of that too. What was that like? And also, I understand at that time, you got a little bit unwell.
Well, that's all true. Yes, 1997 was a big year for us. Again, I rewind the tape to the hard days, the hours and hours and hours on end that we spent working in Diggs Lane trying to put a show together, then moving it to the SFX. It was a dilapidated old building, and the amount of blood, sweat and tears and blisters that came out of that to get us to 1997. Yes, we did the Oscars. Yes, we sold out every big arena from Tokyo to Texas and from Mexico to Moscow and to Beijing. And we sold out football stadiums. I dreamed that a dance show, that a dancer could be the center act, that it didn't just have to be a singer or a pop star, that dance could be the main event. Nobody believed me. I was the only one who believed in it. But by the end of 1997, we outsold nearly every big rock band in the world and every big touring act. We were number one.
And I understand you were called the Irish Michael Jackson. You mentioned Diggs Lane, and by chance, that's now where my radio station is based. So we feel your spirit every day. And I know you're also involved in spirits and in whiskey, and you've got so many interests. You're born in 1958, Irish parents from Sligo and Carlo. And tell us about your grandmother, who was a gifted dancer. In a way, you got a little bit of that sprinkly of sprinkle magic in your feet. And tell us about your wonderful feet. You broke that Guinness World Record.
Thank you, Henry. You've certainly done your research, son.
I haven't.
Yes. Hannah Ryan was the champion dancer in the family. She was my grandmother. My mother was Eilish Ryan. My grandfather, Paddy Ryan, from Carlow, was a champion hammer thrower and discus thrower. My father, Michael Flatley, was born in Battlefield Kulfatha in County Sligo. He played the fiddle, but he was also a great boxer. My uncle Tommy was a Connacht champion boxer, and I believe he held a record in the mile. My father's mother was a poet and known for her poetry work, but both sides of the family were exceptionally hard working and goal oriented and driven people, which is probably where I get it from.
And you are driven. I mean, that presidency, you were, toying at that idea of running for presidency. There was a lot of love for you in the country. You've decided against it. And even today in this room, so many people have such fond thoughts of you. What is it you love about Ireland and your Irish heritage, and what keeps you going? Here we are 30 years on, Lord of the Dance. It's going to be huge. Again, you're not going to be dancing yourself, but you might play the flute.
Henry, thanks for saying that. I can promise you one thing. Whatever happens on February the 5th at the Point, the Three Arena in Dublin, we're going to pack that place out and we're going to blow the roof off of that. We've not yet begun to fight, Henry. We've only just warmed up. This is going to take off like a rocket. And we started a month ago in South Africa to standing ovations, then on to Australia. And they just finished in Taiwan, where we sold out in front of tens of thousands of people. You asked me what was important about being Irish. Well, if you want my answer, and I'll stand alone if I have to on this, the greatest race of people on earth. And I, around a few beers, might have an argument with my Australian mates or African buddies or my French or Italian friends, and they believe their country's the best. And I love them for that. They're patriots. Of course, I'm right, Henry. The Irish are the best. Warm, loving, caring people, but driven, determined, unstoppable people. I believe in the young people. I believe in the young minds. I believe that the young people of Ireland need to stand up now and be counted. This is their country. They're well-educated, highly intelligent, driven and determined young people, and they can lead Europe into a brighter future. They will bring us to places we never dreamed possible. They will do things that we couldn't accomplish in our time. I say to the young people, stand up and be better than your fathers. Dream bigger while still being thankful to what your fathers have given you.
Michael Flatley, thank you so much for chatting to me. Henry McKean here on The Rewind.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Flatley there, on tour again with the Lord of the Dance 30 years on. Up next, the big news stories of 1997 with Richie McCormack. And you're very welcome back to The Rewind. It's 1997, and I'm here with Richie McCormack, and he is the digital audio broadcast manager, Bauer Media Audio Ireland. Richie, now that is a big title, and thank you so much for joining us.
They just threw a lot of words up in the air, Henry, scattered them down the ground together and assigned them to me. That's where we are now.
Well, today you are our 1997 news expert. You're going to bring us back to those big stories from that year. I know for me in 1997, I do remember this Hong Kong changeover, the fact that Britain handed back Hong Kong to China. Do you remember that time?
I do remember very tearful Chris Patton, who was in charge, who was basically the emissary from the UK to Hong Kong at the time, being pretty tearful.
It has been the greatest honour and privilege of my life to share your home for 5 years and to have some responsibility for your future. Now, Hong Kong people are to run Hong Kong. That is the promise, and that is the unshakable destiny.
I was actually, the date that it happened, I was on holidays in Portugal at the time. So one of the things that was the case around then, this is talking about pre-mobile phones and pre-internet, is that we were still obviously seeing a lot of UK papers around then. So you had a very direct...
That was a big influence.
Yeah, it was.
British media.
And it was a huge story at the time. And I think it was... I don't know if it's fed into a lot of the modern day British psyche now, but the ceding of control to one of the last empire posts back to China. At the time, I think it was probably shrugged off. It's probably had a deeper resonance in the British psyche than I think perhaps they would have expected at the time. I know obviously there was a lot of chatter about them obviously giving back, you know, part of what was their, what they saw as their right and they saw as their territory back to China, and whether or not that was a regressive move. It makes sense, and is Hong Kong better off being a Chinese outpost or a British outpost? That's debatable, and that's for the people of Hong Kong for themselves to decide. What would seem like a more natural progress would be for it obviously to revert to being Chinese territory. But at the time, there certainly was that chatter of, should we really be conceding more of our empire, and is this eroding our standing worldwide to be seen to be doing this? At the time, I think it seemed like a logical step. In the long term, and being, what, 28 years removed from it now, I think that has had a role to play in what we're currently seeing in the UK and its sense of national identity.
And there were powerful images of then Prince Charles on the royal yacht on Britannia that was also decommissioned, you could say.
Yeah.
The empire was decommissioning at that time. I'm now going to move on to a change in government, and we had a new Taoiseach.
Yeah, we did have a new Taoiseach in Bertie Ahern, who obviously came to power. It was, it was a changeover from the Rainbow Coalition. I think there seems to be a desire, and that was clearly borne out in how the results came from the electors, to see a more centralised way forward for the country. But thinking back to the time, I think it took a few years, I'd imagine, for the appreciation for what had been done, because a lot of what came in terms of like the Good Friday Agreement obviously being a year later, with the work that was done with the economy, like a lot of those wheels set in motion, regardless of how your political affinities may lay, a lot of those wheels were set in motion during that Rainbow government's time and were ultimately brought to fruition in a lot of cases by the Fianna Fáil led government. And that's what obviously they will take a lot of credit for. And they'll, you know, it's only the people in power at the time of the events that will only ever take credit for them. But I think there's been an appreciation once we have a bit of remove, once certain characters from that Rainbow Coalition have sadly passed away, that there's more of an appreciation of what they actually did to lay that groundwork for the likes of Bertie Ahern. But I think from Fianna Fáil, with support from the PDs getting elected at the time, there was a sense that we just want a singular way forward. And Bertie had done a remarkable job of rebranding himself. I mean, we'll get to the Tony Blair New Labour stuff in a moment, I guess, with the UK in their own election in May of that year. But Bertie had done a lot of brand work himself. And I think from working in media for as long as myself and yourself have, you can see that him developing, being that 80s minister for Labour, shuffling around behind Charles Haughey in a duffel coat kind of thing, looking a bit scruffy to getting his act together. And I think that played a big role. And I think there was that sense that being a bit more media savvy, being a bit more presentable to camera, was going to play a bigger and better role in how politics was presented, never mind the actual depth or realities and meaning to it all. But certainly on a surface level, he'd done a lot of work, and the party had done a lot of work, I think, to remove themselves from that old Haughey-ist Albert Reynolds way to being a little bit more present and future savvy.
And Bertie Ahern went on to win three general elections and did dominate in Irish politics for years to come. And yeah, we're going to move on to Tony Blair.
Rightly and wrongly, some might say, but then with the a lot more to do as well with their latter rounds of elections. Like, that'll tell you about how successful or otherwise those terms in office were.
Oh, huge. And yeah, New Labour, bring us back to the UK.
New Labour was, again, we talk about people not necessarily getting credit for how things were brought around. John Smith should have been the Prime Minister of the UK to follow on from John Major. I don't, like, Tony Blair would probably tell you that, but unfortunately, due to an unfortunate event one morning at the Barbican where he suffered a heart attack and died, and ultimately Tony Blair came to power. But the idea of New Labour was a Peter Mandelson pretty much creation, along with Tony Blair, and had come into being originally under John Smith, and they were moving in that direction before Blair came to power. By 97, the UK, whatever about Ireland needing a sense of a different way forward and perhaps a more singular way forward, the UK were crying out for a change in government, because they'd had the Tories in place since the late 70s. Thatcher obviously had been in charge during the vast majority of that. And then it was, when we talk about them losing a sense of identity with conceding empirical ground, they'd lost a sense of identity in that the person that was in charge of the country was seen as being at the time such a grey non-entity as a presence and as a persona.
As in John Major.
That he was literally presented as being grey-skinned on Spinning Image.
He was.
And was just...
It turns out he was far more interesting afterwards. He found out about his love life.
Completely. And I think a more interesting character, even removing the Edwina Curry stuff. Like, there is a very... You don't get to that point in your career. You don't get to be the leader of a country like Great Britain without actually having a bit of depth to your character. And I think that was only discovered again afterwards. But with Labour coming to power in May of 97... It's too easy to say that it rode a kind of cultural tidal wave, but there was a sense that the culture in the UK had shifted. They had finally gotten a bit of economic stability, but they wanted to really grasp the reins of that. And Labour was seen as a means and seen as a cooler alternative. And you can, you know, scoff at it now, but they were seen as the cooler, younger, hipper alternative. Like, Blair was still in his 40s by the time he came to power in Great Britain at the time. Contrast that with the, you know, your, for the best one in the world, your John Majors, your Douglas Hurds, your Kenneth Clarks, etc., etc. They were seen as the old guard. And there was very much a new broom that came along with Labour.
And I remember that Ford Galaxy pulling up at 10 Downing Street with Doreen. I know the song came out a few years earlier.
Yeah.
Things Can Only Get Better. And then the whole Britpop, and I understand Blur and Oasis showed up at 10 Downing Street somewhere around that time. So they were considered cool.
Yeah, there was this, it was a nonsense thing of Cool Britannia at the time, which Labour tapped into, which the bands of that era tapped into as well, some more than others, and the Labour government should probably rightly face derision for it, because there's nothing cool about a government, nor should there ever be anything cool about a government. That's not their job. Their job is to run the country. It doesn't matter whether or not you're cool in doing it. It's to do it right. And the bands attaching themselves to that as well, I think the likes of Noel Gallagher and Alan McGee and others who were present at that cocktail party at Downing Street that year would look back on it with a sense of regret.
Oh, they do regret it, yeah.
Yeah, it's even taking out what Tony Blair and that Labour government led the UK into with the war in Iraq a couple of years later, even in that sense in 1997, to be rubbing shoulders with the, you know, those in 10 Downing Street,
with the
government, with quote unquote, the man, not a great look if you're setting yourself up as being like, even in the mildest sense, anti-establishment.
She was the people's princess. And that's how she will stay, how she will remain in our hearts and in our memories forever.
Now something incredibly moving and sad, and everyone listening will remember where they were when Princess Diana was killed in a car crash in Paris. Can you remember where you were?
Yeah, I got up. I was in bed, obviously, when it happened. But when I got up that Sunday morning and turned on the TV, just ready to watch whatever it was that, you know, as a 15-year-old me would have been watching on TV at the time, and just being confronted by these news stories. And you're like, oh, what? Because you're not expecting to see the news at like 8, 9 o'clock in the morning. Then it was like the immediate reaction was to rush upstairs and tell my parents. And from that point on, with this removed from it now, you can only describe what happened to England in particular in that week that followed as a sense of mania.
It was hysteria.
One of the things that pops up when you see your programs looking back in 1997, or you see the reaction to it, the one that sticks in my memory more even than the flowers outside of Buckingham Palace, that's a more, somebody dies, you place flowers. I remember being in New York and placing flowers at David Bowie's apartment because that was, you know, what you do. When you see the release of the version of Candle in the Wind, that was even the notion that Elton John would go back into the studio the week of a major celebrity's death, which is what she was, and re-record one of his best-known songs with her-centric lyrics.
Yeah.
And then singing at the funeral. So Elton John singing at a member of the royal family's funeral.
They were friends.
They were friends, sure, but it is a member of the royal family's, you know, funeral. Singing at the funeral, then release it as a single. There's these pictures and film that comes with the release of that single whereby, like, that stayed at number one for a number of weeks, stayed in the charts beyond that as well into the...
It was huge.
Into the early winter, really. But there was people on the opening day going in and buying, like, stacks of these singles.
Yeah.
And I'd love to speak to those people now and gone, A, what was the thinking then? And B, do you still have those 12 copies of Candle in the Wind / Something in the Way You Look Tonight? Because it was a mania in that pre-internet and pre-wanting to show your every thought at every moment of the day and your stance on absolutely everything, you had to plant your flag in the ground of mourning for Princess Diana if you're a British subject that week.
You had to. I mean, on that, like, I was on a plane heading to Gran Canaria, going on a leaving cert holiday, and the pilot announced it on the plane in the sky before we landed and said, we have some news breaking that... Diana has died in a car crash in Paris, and we just couldn't believe it.
But like, but why would you, like, similar to my reaction of why would I run upstairs and tell my parents, why would a pilot announce that to people flying to Gran Canaria?
Elton John on the right there. Elton John, who will be singing with his partner David Furnish beside him. Elton John, who the princess at the funeral of Versace was comforting, and George Michael, the singer, on the right.
Now in the nave, Elton John sings Candle in the Wind with new words specially written a few days ago by Bernie Taupin.
Goodbye, England's rose.
If you look back on it at the time as well, and I come from obviously a massive sporting background in terms of like my work, England had a home international in the week that followed the funeral, or there or thereabouts, against Moldova. It would have been a qualifier for the 98 World Cup.
Yes, France.
And before the match, like, everybody's wearing black armbands, like the England players are wearing black armbands. You kind of go, all right, yeah, fair enough. They have this moment before the game where they play the Elton John version of Candle in the Wind at Wembley. And people are looking solemn and looking down the ground. I'm like, why is that invading a football space in 1997? Like, even now we struggle to get our head around the hysteria that goes along with the poppy and the show-off nature of you have to be seen to be more in tune with celebrating their armed forces than anybody else, to the point where you have people in poppy costumes walking out in front of, you know, there's that kind of stuff. But why were they playing Candle in the Wind before a football match?
Well, I met Diana as a school child in Scotland.
Really?
And yeah, and what I'll say to that is she had so much charisma, so much beauty. I think I was 10 years of age, Charles was beside her. And I've told the story before. I won a raffle at school to go along to the opening of a wing at Glasgow Cathedral, a new wing. And what happened was she came over, Charles came over, she came over, Di came over. And he just said, Charles just said, boys, are you working hard? And we said, we said back, yes, Your Highness. And he said, don't call me Your Highness, call me Charles. And Diana didn't speak. Obviously, there was three in the marriage even at that stage. This was 1988 we met.
Yeah.
And Di didn't speak, but she was so beautiful, so charismatic, and people really did love her. And to use that, go back to Tony Blair, she was seen as the people's princess.
She wasn't. I remember the coverage around that summer before she died. She was obviously involved in this relationship with Dodi Al-Fayed.
Mm.
But like, the people were looking for every scrap of information about that relationship. And on the day she died, there is one paper in the UK that subsequently had to apologise because its first edition went to print talking about how Diana was sex mad. And you're going, we don't have the right as a people to have that level of intimacy with somebody's relationship, a stranger's relationship.
The British tabloids were terrible
at that
time.
But the British tabloids, but that shows you the level of, you know, they suddenly swung from wanting to know every intimate detail against her will about her private life into, if you're not bloody well mourning this the right way, we'll have you, kind of thing. And the person who suffered that probably the most and suffered the ire of that the most is probably the Queen, because she was seen to be not doing enough when there's all these protocols in place that she's just like, okay, I have to go by these protocols and this is what we'll do. And the British public, after like a day or two, were like, no, lower flags, look more sad, come out and meet the people. They were dictating the terms of how the mourning of this huge event would take place. And to look back on it with nearly 30 years of retrospect, it was a deeply strange week.
Richie McCormack, thank you so much for bringing us back to 1997. This is The Rewind.
David O'Callaghan from the Here and Back Again podcast.
David, it's great to have you back on The Rewind. It's the year 1997. I don't know if it was a classic year for movies and TV, but it was definitely an important year. Lots happened. We're going to start, I suppose, by talking about the biggest film of the year. What was it?
Yeah, and it was a huge risk at the time. Like, imagine pitching a movie that's 3 hours long. It's a romantic epic where one of the lead character dies. It's a historical drama set on a boat and it's directed by a guy who's only done sci-fi movies. And yes, Titanic with Jack and Rose.
Titanic
absolutely smashed it. Kate and Leo, directed by James Cameron. It was the sensation of the year. It made nearly 3 times the box office of the second movie worldwide and made actually 1.8 billion worldwide and was the first movie ever to make a billion. Now, these days, sure, they're all making billions every now and then, but was the first movie to make a billion worldwide at cinema.
Huge money. And I remember working in a video store at the time and people used to come in and say, do you have a copy of Titanic? And I'd say, no, we didn't. And we had hundreds of copies when it came out on video.
And it was, you know what, and the reason it made so much money also was, it was kind of, because it happened with Marvel years later, is the rewatchability. People were going to see it 10, 20 times, as if like they were watching at home. People were going back to the cinema, going back outside and queuing up again and going back in. It was mad stuff, but absolutely brilliant, yeah. I'm the king of the
world! It was 3 hours. I remember taking a girl to it and there was an interval. And so the interval was lovely.
Yeah, yeah.
More popcorn. Nowadays, they make you just watch the whole thing in
yes.
one go. So it was massive. What other big movies?
So other ones in the big, I suppose, franchise IP world, you had Men in Black, you had Jurassic Park, Lost World, which was the bad one. Air Force One, I was a particular fan of. Liar Liar with Jim Carrey. My Best Friend's Wedding was a huge romantic hit.
And that came out.
Yeah, yeah. And then I suppose the big surprise indie hit of the year was The Full Monty. Sure, everybody was dancing to that at the local disco.
And yeah, and Tom Jones had another lease of life. You can leave your hat on. You can leave.
leave your hat on. You can leave your hat on.
That was a massive movie set in Sheffield. All these workers that didn't have any work.
Kind of put Robert Carlyle fully on the map for everybody. And yeah, fantastic. And again, a lot of people really, and it still stood the test of time. Obviously got the musical stage show in London and all that, and on and on. And then on the more indie, I suppose, kind of cool side of releases, this was the year that Boogie Nights, Paul Thomas Anderson, who's out there at the moment, his movie Boogie Nights. Then you had Good Will Hunting, good old Ben and Matt, was a big hit. Quentin's Jackie Brown, we love a bit of Jackie Brown.
Loved Jackie Brown.
And then James Ellroy's L.A. Confidential, which, as we discussed before, still stands the test of time. It's beautifully
watched
shot.
Watched it again recently, and it's a classic.
And two, I want to shout out, this is a personal shout out, because no one really cares about these movies. Well, most people don't. It's Starship Troopers, Paul Verhoeven's kind of sci-fi soap opera. Absolutely violent as hell, all about fascism, unbelievable. I've probably watched it about 20 to 30 times.
So a cult film.
Cult film that is just iconic. And then this was the year that Studio Ghibli and Miyazaki were introduced to the world, because Princess Mononoke became the first animated movie from the studio to break outside into, the rest of the world. And 4 years later, Spirited Away took the Oscar. So that was a big year for Studio Ghibli.
So the Japanese, they had a breakout.
Yeah, and when it won the Oscar, people were like, what's this? But already it was now, the Japanese Walt Disney was becoming a thing. And speaking of Oscars, out of that bunch of movies in 1997, Titanic ran amok and won 11 Oscars, equaling Ben-Hur. So that was
wow. And Leonardo DiCaprio still making hits.
Yeah, absolutely. He's still out there. Speaking of the actual Oscars in the year, so in the February of that year, the Oscars in 97, which was for the previous year, The English Patient was the big winner with 9 over test time. I don't know if it should get 9, that's just me.
And well, Fargo, was very Oscar-y.
Yes, back in those days, Oscar, you could smell an Oscar movie from 20 yards, whereas now it's a complete flip of a coin. You don't know what's going to happen. But Fargo did win 2 Oscars.
Fargo, love what it. A movie.
Love it.
It's still fantastic. You know, in the snow, all that death.
Yeah.
All that blood.
And it's just the humour. It's just amazing. Like, it's just absolutely. I wish the Coen brothers would get back together and stop making movies by themselves.
Hey, they said they were going to the Twin Cities.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, is that useful to you?
Oh, you betcha, yeah.
Yeah.
And we're now going to move on to television. It was also, lots happened in TV.
Yeah, you could argue that TV was probably a stronger thing, things were happening, because the big kind of, one of the hottest locations, I suppose, to come out of 1997 was Sunnydale. What is Sunnydale? Well, Joss Whedon decided to make a TV series based on a 1992 movie, which bombed to the hilt, called Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and then made this TV show, which went on for 7 seasons, was a phenomenon. You had spin-offs like Angel.
Buffy was massive. Buffy was huge. I mean, that was basically 1997.
Yeah, she's one of the most iconic teen dramas ever in the history of time. Like, they're remaking this year, or coming early next year, Chloe Zhao, who is a massive Buffy fan. So she's doing Hamnet, which is coming later this year, and did Nomadland. She's directing the pilot. Sarah Michelle Gellar's back. Buffy, still to this day, people quote Buffy all over the place. And I love Buffy so much. So that was massive. And then also, funny enough, when you're looking at things, you kind of go, oh my god, that was this year. The story of 4 boys who live in a fictional town in Denver, Colorado. South Park launched that year.
And South Park was 1997.
South Park 1997, and here we are 27 years later, and they're still as relevant as ever, because they seem to be the only people willing to go head on at Donald Trump. And it's quite amazing what they do, and they're just so irreverent. And they were, but when they came out in 1997, the world went mad for them, like.
And they really were right in your face. They were brilliant, cutting jokes, far more cutting than The Simpsons. Yeah, you have a story to tell us about your time with South Park.
I worked for let's just say a major bookseller and retailer and stationer, and I got sent to Clonmel for Christmas, and basically it was the year of South Park, and our wholesaler wouldn't take the product because they're like, what are you talking about? What's this nonsense? So I went and ordered, and let's just say I may have got the numbers wrong on overorders, because 2 trucks turned up.
2 trucks full of South Park
plush. And I mean, these weren't small plush, these were giant plush of about 40, 50 quid. And the stock rooms, there was no room to move. And I found out later on that after a certain giant megastore in Aston Quay, Clonmel was the second biggest order on the island of Ireland.
Wow.
But the good news is, once the megastore sold out, it became a pilgrimage. We had customers from Belfast, Cork, Galway, all over who heard.
Just to buy some Cartman.
You can own
Cartman, yeah, I should
yeah,
say.
Yeah, Cartman, toys. Respect my authority. People were coming in and they said, are you the South Park shop? And it was amazing. And the day, and the Christmas Eve I left, we found the last toy, plush damaged toy. We sold it for half price because someone had come in looking for it. But people would walk in, and I love it. I love that. And I have about four of the plushes in my house still at this stage because it's just great. And for the show to be still going 27 years on and still, like, I think
more
it's
relevant than ever.
And it's amazing because they do the. They tar everybody. So if you go after everybody, you can't be accused of being something because there's nobody safe on South Park. And as you can, at the moment, it's Donald Trump. And they're the. It's amazing the stuff they're getting away with. It's brilliant.
And what else happened in 1997?
So also that year, Ally McBeal launched. So
massive.
Calista Flockhart turned up with her quirky crew of attorneys. And it was kind of a romance story set in an attorney's office. And like Vonda Shepherd, like I went to see her in the Olympia. God, you know, the things you do. But it was just like a lovely, safe, funny. Well, it was. Now, I'm a huge Bon Jovi fan. And it's fifth season, John Bon Jovi turned up as the love interest. And even I was like, ah, no.
That is unbelievable. They managed to get John Bon Jovi.
Yeah, but he had cut his hair and we're like, no, I'm not having this. So I was like, no more, no more. But no, that was a huge, like people with that was, you'd sit down on whatever night, Monday or Tuesday and watch it. So that was huge. And then bizarrely, before Ted Lasso came along, there was a show on Sky called Dream Team. I don't know if you remember
it. I do. It was like a sort of soap opera.
A soap opera set in the Premier League, and Sky made it. And because they had all the footage of the matches, they could kind of fake put in Harchester United was the name of the team. And it was nonsense of the highest order, but it was. It was like
but
7 o'clock.
It.
7 o'clock on a Tuesday and a Wednesday. You just and I went for 10 seasons. Like
10 seasons.
I don't think I made 10 seasons, but I couldn't believe it. And then they got out of Dodge, and now, sure, sports things are all the rage. So I'm surprised they didn't come back. Preschool was very big at the time. Obviously, it always is. But in the TV world, this is the year. God, well, depends on your opinion. Teletubbies turned up.
I remember Teletubbies. I remember being in college. We used to sit down and watch Teletubbies. So strange that you had students watching a kid.
It was preschoolers
preschool.
And stoners, I think, was who enjoyed it
stoners,
most.
Yeah.
It was very creepy. It freaked me out anyway. But there was another show actually launched the same year. And because of my job, I used to look out for preschool books and kind of merch. And Bear in the Big Blue House was the US version, but never really broke out. It was a Jim Henson product, but it was really the Teletubbies took over the world. And then finally on TV, Alan Partridge. I'm Alan Partridge rocked up.
That came out in 1997. Alan Partridge.
Cringe Fest.
Brilliant.
Steve Coogan, Graveyard Slot, Radio Norwich DJ. He's got, there's too many quotes. We all know who Alan Partridge is, but to this day, my favourite, I even use it myself. When he was asked which album is his favourite Beatles album, he goes, that's a tough one, but I think I'd have to say the best of. And now when anybody says to me, oh, what's your favourite Radiohead album? I go, oh, it's probably the best of. Like, it's just, like, he's an icon.
He's amazing. And I remember him saying, Wings are better than the Beatles. And wow, I mean, that's, wow.
Yeah. Well, that's your whole, you're sitting there going, no, he didn't. He's not going to say that. Or he did. Very Curb Your Enthusiasm. You know, that kind of, oh, he did not just do that. And I just love Alan Partridge. Yeah, brilliant.
David O'Callaghan, thank you for bringing us back to the pop culture of 1997.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for Rewind 1997. Thanks to Simon Tierney and Claire Darmody. Until the next time, I'm Henry McKean. And this is The Rewind.
Going down to South Park, gonna have myself a time.
Friendly faces everywhere, humble folks without temptation.
Going down to South Park, gonna leave my woes behind.
And we're parking day or night, people spouting out in neighbor.
Heading on up South Park, gonna see if I can't unwind. So come on down to South Park and meet some.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.